last time.
And you're listening to The First Time here on Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that made them who they are today. And my guest this week is a singer and songwriter whose career, over the course of five albums, has traversed folk, pop, electronica, R&B, and with her latest record, soulful, stripped-back sonic exploration. Whether collaborating with David Lynch or covering Drake, she brings her own intensely personal voice to everything she does. I'm very pleased to say my guest on The First Time this week is Licky Lee. You just heard I Follow Rivers from 2011's Wounded Rhymes, a track that's gained a life of its own, and we'll discuss what it feels like as an artist to have one of those songs later in the show. We'll talk about Licky's tentative journey towards a music career and how an experience at a New York open mic night became a defining moment for her, and also how her explorations into experimental forms of therapy have informed both her and her latest album. We'll also discuss that aforementioned collaboration with David Lynch and talk about why artists such as Nina Simone and This Mortal Coil mean so much to her. But I started off by asking, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time she was aware of music?
I have very vivid memories of I lived in Portugal from when I was 4 until 9. So being in Portugal, and there was always music blasting, a combination of Bob Dylan, Bob Marley, African music, classical music. Arvo Pärt, Spiegel im Spiegel, because that was a song that my mom would always put on when she was cleaning the house.
Tell me about that song then.
It has that melancholy of being able to catch the pain of life in melody and space. Also, it's very bare, very beautiful. Yeah.
Was music always around you when you were growing up?
Yeah, my dad is a musician as well. So he was always in different bands growing up. In Sweden, he was in this kind of like prog band when I was a baby. And then in Portugal, he was in this Portuguese band that did like fado, and then like Algerian band. And then when he moved back to Sweden, when I was at some point, then he started doing like dub music.
So he did like all different kinds of stuff.
Yeah. When we lived in Sweden, he always had a little home studio and recording like dogs and like cicadas and running things to like echo machines, like dub, basically.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So was music like, did it feel like a valuable thing at home? Was it treated with respect, or was it just like every day there's just music around?
Yeah, it's just there. And then when I had the power of choice, I had a Walkman, and I was also the middle child. So I kind of, you know, didn't feel at ease in the world or in my family. So I would always kind of sit, you know, in the middle seat in the back of the car with like my Walkman on and listen to Michael Jackson and Madonna.
I mean, that's two pretty strong. I mean, if you're going to go pop.
Exactly. Know. It was like, okay. You know?
Well, what about the first, I mean, I guess you would have seen your dad perform live, but.
But I hated, seeing him perform live.
No
I hated
way.
Going to shows. Yeah.
Why?
I mean, my son is the same. He hates when I start singing or if I have to like play a mix at home or like he never wants to come to my show.
Why is that? Why didn't you like it then?
I don't know. Isn't it like kind of Greek mythology that you're supposed to like detest your parents? Like a hero's journey to like move away from your parents, right? So like, you know, whenever my dad wants to like play me something, it's really like I have like a physical reaction. Like I don't want to hear it. Oh my God, he's probably going to listen to this.
But I guess that changes and you look back and you think, oh, that's really cool to be brought up like that.
Yeah, why not?
Okay, what about the first concert you went to then?
I actually didn't go to a lot of concerts. I remember the concerts I didn't go to. I remember my sister got to go to Michael Jackson and I didn't get to go.
Oh, you must have been gutted.
Yeah, and then when D'Angelo played in Stockholm, he played the Voodoo album. And for some reason, I'm like, I don't know. So I missed that. So I kind of like feel like I went, but I didn't go. I mean, D'Angelo Voodoo, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Like with his shirt off. I will carry that into my grave.
First falling in love with Nina Simone then?
Well, I heard the live version of Who Knows Where the Time Goes. And there's just something, you know, I love hearing like all the sounds. You can tell that she's like in a bar in New York. And there's something about her voice that, because I've always struggled with my voice as well. And especially growing up, I kind of always got told that I really didn't have a good voice, and I like auditioned for things and people would always kind of laugh in my face. And this was the time too where Mariah Carey and Whitney Houston were like so big to really, you know how to like belt out and wail. So I felt when I heard Nina Simone, I was like, like it doesn't matter that, you know, like that it's not perfect. All that matters is that it's so direct. When I listen to Nina Simone, it's like I'm listening to like a beating, bleeding heart. And the voice is kind of just a way of transporting that. It's like that's not the point. you know, it just needs to come out. And then the way that she plays the piano solo, like, I die.
Sad deserted shore, your fickle friends are leaving. Then you know, then it's time for them to go. But I will still be here. I have no thought of leaving. For I do not count the time. Who knows where the time goes? Who knows where the time
So when people were telling you that you couldn't sing, how did that feel? Did it make you think, screw them, they're wrong? Or did it break your heart every time?
No, it broke my heart. I remember growing up, anytime I would kind of like sing in my bedroom, I would walk out and like my sister and all her friends would just be like laughing at me. And like,
no way.
And like when I first went to New York too, when I was 19, I got like booed out.
What happened?
I got booed out at this open mic. I didn't also, I quit dancing high school when I was like 15. And I'm like, I want to be a musician. So I applied for the music school, like, and I didn't get in. So yeah, it's for me that stayed with me for a long time.
Do you think you still carry some of that?
Oh yeah.
Okay. So when does that become, well, I'm going to do this anyway? What's the moment that you think, I'm not going to let that stop me?
I think the moment I got booed out in New York, that was a real critical moment where it's like, okay, either I like really quit now, but instead I had this kind of revenge feeling, like I'll come back. So that was a very pivotal moment for me.
Where does that come from? That sense of defiance then?
Well, I think it's just a survival mechanism. Don't we all just want to survive? Like, if I wasn't going to do music, then, like, what was I going to do? I didn't have any other plans.
Hands down. I'm too proud for love.
Tell me about your first time at a recording studio then. When did you first record?
Well, my dad had, he was a part of this Rub-A-Dub studios that was like all analog. So I would like maybe sing in his studio a little bit, but I didn't really like it. But I remember the first time probably I was like properly singing my own songs was when Björn Yttling took me under his wings, and probably when I recorded a little bit, actually.
Okay, so that was the first time.
Yeah, and that's the problem too. When I, you know, I've always had a really hard time singing in the studio. I get really, really insecure. So I think even when I hear that song, like the way that I'm singing is like very breathy and like trembling, is because I was truly like peeing myself, you know, out of discomfort.
Because it still sounds good, that EP, that track.
Yes, something, right? Like that kind of... And that's why, I don't know, that's why I put the Shangri-Las on the list too.
Okay, go on.
Because I remember, you know, the feedback I was getting based on that first EP was kind of like, this like Swedish girl, Lolita, like so many times they called me girl, girlish, so girlish. That really rubbed me the wrong way, because in my mind, I was like a suffering human being, you know, and like kind of the way you grow up too, you listen to like Dylan, you listen to so much men, you know, everyone is a man. And like, that's real music, you know, like Bruce Springsteen. So to be called a girl was such a slap in the face. So when I first found the Shangri-Las, that's why I was like, here's someone that the sounds like girls, and like it's very deep, you know, so I could relate to like, you can somehow be a bit serious and still be sounding like a girl.
Yeah, it's true. A lot of those, the kind of early girl groups, they're girl gangs.
Exactly.
Aren't they? That's there's a real, no matter how saccharine some of the pop seemed, it wasn't really. It was powerful music.
Very
and also
powerful.
They were strong to get to do that.
Yeah, you know? Strong and vulnerable at the same time. I'm gonna hide if she don't leave me alone. I'm gonna run away. Don't. 'Cause you can never go home anymore. Listen. Does this sound familiar? You wake up every morning, go to school every day, spend your nights on the corner, just passing time away. Your life is so lonely, like a child without a toy. Then a miracle, a boy. And that's called glad. Now my mom is a good mom, and she loves me with all her heart. But she said I was too young to be in love, and the boy and I would have to part. And no matter how I ranted and raved, I screamed, I pleaded, I cried. She told me it was not really love, but only my girlish pride. And that's called bad. Happen to you, don't let this. I packed my clothes and left home that night. Though she begged me to stay, I was sure I was right. And you know something funny? I forgot that boy right away. Instead, I remember being tucked in bed and hearing my mama say, hush, little baby. You cry. Mama won't go.
When that first album came out, which is 2008, things kind of really lifted. You can kind of, there's that moment when a career, not it leaves your hands, but it becomes wider. The screen gets wider, doesn't it? I just wondered how that felt. There's nothing like when it happens with the first record. The second record, even if it goes through the roof, or the third record's the one that goes global, it doesn't matter. That first time, you can never copy that. You can never repeat it.
No, and I guess that's like a miracle that now I realize that I've been around for so long, and like I've been around for 15 years. This is my fifth record. And like when you release a record, you'll be like, does anyone care? Because people care about something new.
Yeah, true.
And there's only a first time for anything. So now I realize how lucky I was.
What do you remember from that? Because it's obviously life, the fast forward button kind of happens when you're in the middle of it, doesn't it?
Yeah, because...
Every day there's a new thing happening.
Crazy things happening. And I think also at that time in your life, you're like, I don't know, was I 20 or something? You're a bit like, you have this like cocky energy. Because you have to, otherwise, you know, that's like just the way you have to kind of be in order to do anything. So to me, it's at that time, it wasn't a surprise. I'm like, of course, you know?
Of course, everybody thinks I'm amazing. I'm amazing.
No, but of course, everyone thinks I'm amazing, but I'm also crying myself to sleep because I suck, you know? So it's a dual thing.
But you've kind of, that's the thing you've got to have. No, you haven't got to. I think it's not uncommon. The self-doubt is often one of the essential keys to doing anything.
Yeah, but the self-confidence is higher, I think, when you're younger. Yeah, you're just a bit naive.
Was it when you started playing those bigger places? I kind of think there's, and this is a simplistic way of thinking about, like up to like about 1,000 people, 1,500 people, that kind of size, most bands can deal with that. It makes sense.
Yeah.
You can see that number of people. Then you get past that.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, that not disconnect, it's harder to deal with, I think, because the audience becomes a different character.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with me is, like, I kind of black out. So, like, I don't have much memories of,
really?
Like, starting years. But it's a little bit like I'm here in Stockholm and there's this place where you go and, like, you swim nude and you can jump off these really high, like, you jump off into the lake. And I'm quite scared of heights. And anyway, I keep on climbing up and, like, and I'm like, why am I doing this? Like, I'm totally scared of heights. And then I, like, just jump and I, like, black out. It's a little bit the same as playing a really big audience. Like, and then you kind of just have to, like, go in and just, like, just hold on for dear life a little bit. Like, hold on to yourself, you know, and the concentration.
But you keep doing it.
Yeah. But I don't know. Now I'm, like, I think I'm playing quite small. I'm like going backwards, you know, in my popularity, which I don't mind. You know, I'm happy I'm still around.
So you've got, and this is something we've talked to a few musicians about, you've got one of those songs. You've got I Follow Rivers. You've got one of those songs that, and this is a really crude way of putting it, it's kind of nothing to do with you anymore. It's just,
which is
a beautiful thing to have. Like, and I always feel a bit weird when artists kind of say, oh yeah, I know, that's my best known song, I don't like it. It's like, well, tough.
Yeah.
I always think it's a thing to be proud of, to connect like that.
Well, I mean, takes you a moment to get there. In the beginning when it happened, I was like, this is, you know, they ruined my song. You know, I worked so hard on like the production.
Really? And you then felt like that?
oh yeah, the remix. I was like, what? You know, like I anything I do is like I try to stay away from Four on the Floor. You know, it's like a thing. I never go there. So I was quite like hurt. But then of course now I realize like this song affords me the luxury of like still being here and making my music. And especially when people, you know, I have like friends, like even like Mark Ronson, who DJs everywhere. He's like, it's crazy. Like anywhere I go, that song kind of just, or like people be like, oh, I was at a wedding, or I was here, or it was a gay parade. Or so it is really happy to have a song that somehow people get happy hearing on the dance floor. Although like I don't, you know, I don't know how to make dance music, and I don't dance to that kind of music either.
Interesting, kind of watch you really experiment with sound with your records and really treat sound like an instrument.
Yeah,
if that makes sense. And someone that does that obviously is Brian Eno, and as a name that you've kind of put forward. I wondered why the.
Well, the crazy thing about that is like, to be, if I'm completely honest, which I'm going to sound like a, such a uneducated musician, like I kind of just started listening to Brian Eno on this album, like before I made this album. And for me, I was like, ah, okay, this is where I want to go next. So that really opened up kind of the palette to what I wanted to make with my latest album. And like how it can be so emotional, and how, you know, even without lyrics or like pop structure, it's like contains such rich world.
Have you dug into some of the amazing sort of studio techniques and stuff he did? Because the man's just like done some insane, crazy stuff.
I feel it. If I dig into that, then I'm going to feel like my whole career is a failure. You know? So like sometimes I stay away from finding out too much or knowing too much, because it really sends me off into like a depression.
He's got this thing called the oblique strategy cards.
Oh no, that actually, my friends and me, we do that at dinner parties. I did that the other night, except when, you know, this couple starts asking the oblique cards, like, should we open our relationship? You know, like it really went quite scenes from a marriage quite fast, you know?
That was The Big Ship by Brian Eno, and we'll be back in a few minutes to talk about Bulgarian choirs and experimental therapy, amongst other things. But first, let's go to the Six Music News.
Six Music. BBC Radio. Six Music.
BBC News at 1:30. This is Anthony Birchley. Rising temperatures are beginning to cause disruption to travel networks. An amber warning is currently in place across most of England and Wales. A red warning of extreme heat is being brought in for parts of England tomorrow. And it's Cadre Report.
As temperatures increase, people are being advised to travel only if necessary. Great Western Railways has already placed speed restrictions on some of its trains. Highways England says it will use so-called cracker dust to help keep the road cool and allow tyres to grip when tarmac becomes sticky in the heat. Police have repeated warnings of people cooling off in rivers and reservoirs after the body of a 16-year-old boy who died after swimming with friends was recovered from Salford Quays. They said it was a sad reminder of the dangers of entering open water, whatever the weather.
Parts of Europe are also struggling with exceptional temperatures. Wildfires in France have led to the evacuation of more than 14,000 people from the popular tourist region of the Gironde. In Spain, more than 3,000 people fled fires in the Mijas Hills in the south of the country. A senior Conservative MP has criticised the tone of the leadership race, saying there's a campaign to crush his preferred candidate, Penny Mordaunt. Earlier, Ms Mordaunt told the BBC she'd been the victim of smears and toxic politics, as pieces have appeared in papers questioning her stance on gender self-identification. Sir Charles Walker is unhappy about how the contest is being handled.
It doesn't reflect well on us, does it? It really doesn't. It's a shame. I wish I could see a way of it stopping. I can't at the moment. I think it requires everybody to draw back, take a deep breath, us as politicians, members of the media, dare I say our constituents, and just calm down and say, look, we can either continue this way with rather unpleasant rancorous discourse, or we can actually just try and improve matters.
Officials say a cargo plane which crashed in northern Greece was carrying 11 tons of weapons, including landmines, from Serbia to Bangladesh. People living more than a mile from the site where it came down, close to the city of Kavala, have been warned to stay indoors. All 8 people on board died. A Welsh rugby star, Ryan Jones, has revealed he has early-onset dementia. The 41-year-old won 75 caps for his country between 2004 and 2014. He says that he feels his world is falling apart. David Walsh is the chief sports correspondent for the Sunday Times and says rugby organisers should have done more to deal with the issue.
It's astonishing to me that rugby, you know, that world rugby and all its various national unions didn't get together at some point about 10 years ago and say, look, guys, we're running into a crisis here and we've got to prepare for it.
And the head of Britain's armed forces has warned that Russia could remain a threat to world security for decades. Admiral Sir Tony Radakin, who's the chief of the defence staff, said speculation that Russia's president was unwell or could be assassinated was wishful thinking. That's Six Music News. More in an hour.
BBC Radio. Six Music.
Wait up, don't wanna wait up for you, baby, still I wait up. Lonely in the canyon, no love. There's no love reflecting in the glow. $1 million man, show me your cup, baby, come clean. Come out of your smoke screen if you really love me. Open my eyes, babe, you bug me. Your kiss is salty. Crying.
And you're listening to The First Time here on Six Music. And my guest this week is singer and songwriter Licky Lee. You just heard Deep End from her 2018 album So Sad, So Sexy. And we'll discuss the challenges involved with making that record and her most recent one, I, over the next half an hour. But first, let's jump back into the conversation as we talk about one of our most influential collaborations. I'd like to talk to you about working with David Lynch. Because we've had him on this show, and he was the most wonderful guest. He was just...
Yeah, he's amazing.
Really charming, really funny, really great tasting music, but also at the same time as still being... He's still David Lynch. Why do you and he click, do you think? What is it?
Well, I don't know if he clicked so much with me. I was obsessed with him, you know? So I don't know. I remember first meeting him. We, like, spoke about, you know, Ingmar Bergman, and obviously, you know, we... probably somehow are like, oh, okay, my bye, man. And then I told him about all my problems in life and like how anxious I was. And then he really taught me how to meditate. So that was like really profound for me, life changing. And like how also when you meet him in person too, he's so happy and light and like fun and like self-deprecating. And his work is so dark. So I found that really interesting and like something I strive towards too in my life.
So the meditation, was that like there was a pre-Lynch and a post-Lynch version of you, you think?
Oh, completely, yeah. I learned that after Wounded Rhymes. So when I wrote, I Never Learn, something kind of clicked in me and I was like really able to like write songs in one long, like I could go in and like finish a whole song in one go. And like I used words that I wasn't even aware that I knew in English. So for me, it was really transformative as a writer.
So Sad, So Sexy, because that was the accepted wisdom. You know, like whenever a record comes out, there kind of has to be, there has to be a story around it. Oh, this is, this is the story, like, oh, so this was the hard record. This was the difficult record to make. Is that true? Was that, was it, or was that just an easy way of talking about it for people?
I feel like that's the record where I kind of like, you know, had like a bit of a, I mean, I'm not going to compare myself to Dylan, but I am. You know, when he went electric and everyone's like, why did you go electric?
Okay.
I feel like I kind of, I like went off my path a little bit there. But that's also what happened to me in real life, like very much. Like it was a very insane time for me. I was like moved to America, had a baby, my mom died, went through a separation, kind of went through this like identity crisis and like, also, I'd made three records in my hometown in a very tight grip, saying no to anyone. Like I early on got offers to like work with very big people. And I was like, no, 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 no. And then I was like in this city, maybe anyone who has a baby, you kind of really go into like a bit of an identity crisis after you shed something and you're like, who am I now? And then I was surrounded by a lot of somehow people. Somehow my gaze had always been to the past musically, but right now I was like very interested in like my favorite artist at that moment was Kendrick Lamar and like Drake. I was very inspired by the contemporary scene, And then I was in LA, like living there for the first time. All of a sudden, there was like a lot of people that kind of wanted to work with me. And then I had very low self-esteem at the time. So I was like, I'm just going to try instead of saying no to everything. And then I made this album that was very honest to me at the time, trying out all these different things. But now that I hear it, like the songs, I think are still quite good, but the production sound very like not, you can hear the influence of a lot of people. And now I kind of wish that maybe I would have done that record for like someone else. Like imagine if kind of Rihanna was singing like all those songs instead. I was like, that would have been amazing. So like, yeah, maybe I shouldn't have released it. But at the same time, the So Sad, So Sexy title to me was so correct. For me, that really like embodied kind of me like getting out of this hole and like what it means to be a woman. So Sad, So Sexy, I was like, damn, that's what it means to be a woman.
Let's look at another track you've chosen, Song to the Siren by This Mortal Coil.
Yeah.
That? When did you first hear that?
It was around the same time as I heard the Nina Simone. I think I was like 18 or something and still trying to like find my own sound and like especially vocals. And when I heard that, I was floored. Like it transports me, like I'm hypnotized by her vocal. And it's still the same. Like my only goal as a singer is to be able to like do a vocal take that is as mesmerizing and transcendent as that take. And maybe it will never happen because it's kind of like a gift from God, the way she did that.
I'm this puzzle that's newborn child. I'm as riddled as the time. Should I stand mid the breakers, or should I lie with death my bride? Hear me sing, swim to me.
The idea of doing psychedelic aided therapy is becoming more prevalent now. Mm. I just wondered how you ended up in that world and if it worked for you, if it helped you.
Oh my God. I mean, it helped me so much. It transformed my life. It was a real, and it was a journey of about 2 years. And like, I guess when I started it, I was really at some type of like complete rock bottom. You know, and I had done so much different types of therapies and like shamans and meditation and like, you know, when there's like lists, you know, like how to like cure your depression, like take a walk or like be grateful, you know, like, ugh. And I was also, you know, when my mom died, I didn't really like process it. I went straight on tour. And like when I was like laying down in a bed, I was kind of like, bury me now because like I'm dead. Or like I was so fatigued in a way that was really scary. Like I really couldn't summon the strength to like feel grateful or to like I was so fatigued. And when I think back about that time, it's scary to me. So then I kind of went on this path of trying, you know, like different things. It's been a long journey and you deal with different things. But I mean, it's been, I am a different person today.
I
did it a lot while I was making I. So even the way that when you're in that altered state, and you know, when you do the ayahuasca ceremonies, it's very much about music. And you realize, I've been here before. This is what I do when I make music. So like you realize, I'm already like, you know, I'm like, I've been here before. And like, this is what I'm doing when I make music. I'm communicating with something higher and I'm like channeling different things. So it's like very interesting. And you realize too, Jimi Hendrix was here. Oh, for sure. Grateful Dead have been here. The Beatles, you know, like they've all been to the side.
And that feeds directly into the record.
Yeah, because I realize like, oh my God, music is like the most holy thing we have. And I have like, I can use this to like get through my pain. I've been kind of manifesting and like repeating really horrible patterns when it comes to love and songwriting. So I was like, this is bad, you know? And especially because it had happened again. So I was like, am I really writing a heartbreak album again? Like as my fifth album, like I'm stuck on something and I don't want to be stuck writing tragic love songs for the rest of my life. So there was like very kind of like a five-dimensional approach to this. Like on one side, okay, let me write the best sad love songs, but I need to also get through this and like close the circle and close this chapter and like open a door to like a new world. So I felt like for me, the musical part was very important for me, that the music transported you to like the light, the new beginning, a beautiful world.
And I wake up on my own, with a little sun outside. You decide, a dream I'll never sold. You're a true night butterfly, is it true boys never cry? With a little sun outside, you are mine, but it's never set in stone.
So interested in like the music and doing the layers and like the way I was mixing, I was like recording, you know, like sounds and like panning things. And so I was like, I would be quite happy just going into like an instrumental world. And maybe I don't have to like my mantra doesn't have to be like, I never learn, you know, or like I'm never gonna love again, or like all these other songs, basically the same song over and over and over and over again.
Because of what I do, I listen to lots of music, and I often this next record by artist, it's totally different. They've done something totally new. It sounds totally different, and it very rarely is. It's normally the same thing. But this, I was like, this is different. This is a different the approach to the vocals, the approach to the performances. It sounds really different, and it was great to hear to be surprised, you know.
I mixed it with Sean Everett, who's a genius, but like I sat behind him for 5 months for like hours every day, you know, and we would play like Breaking the Waves on the TV, and like we were kind of like painting this like sonic, we were trying to like find the DNA of like sound, you know? So like I don't think he's ever done anything like that either. We were like really going into each sound and being like, does this sound like regret? And then we would like put it in a tape machine, put it through the thing, record it in the other room, bring it back, put it on tape, record the cicadas. I wanted you to really move through the album, and like the whole album is kind of one long trip.
Final thing we ask everybody is to pick the last piece of music that we play. What's the song that we should go out on?
Well, it's a song, yeah, the Bulgarian State Television Female Choir, Kalimanka Odenko.
This is not a song I'm familiar with or an act I'm familiar
with. No, but when you hear it, you're going to start crying and realize this is the best thing you've ever heard.
How did you come across this? Tell me.
Well, somehow I just came across it, and this was the last time that I had like a bit of a religious experience listening to a song. You know, it doesn't happen, happens maybe once every couple of years. So this was the last one. And I was like, oh my God.
I don't know anything more about
it. Well, it's a Bulgarian state television female choir. That's what it is. So like they they sing, it's completely a cappella, and like, right. I mean, the harmonies, their voices, it's, I've never heard anything like it.
Then that's the last song we'll play. It's been really good to speak to you.
Okay, thank you so much.
That was the Bulgarian State Television Female Choir with Kalimanku Denku, which means the evening gathering. The final choice of my guest on the first time this week, Licky Lee. Head to the BBC Sounds app to listen back to other episodes from this series, including my chats with Herbie Hancock, Shun Kuti and Alex Kapranos from Franz Ferdinand. I'll be back next week with a legend that is Joan Armatrading. But for now, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.